Reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 5, Text 37. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Tuvyam. Vasudevaya Dhimahi Pradyumnaya Nirutaya Namah Shankaya Shanaya Cha. Let us all chant the glories of Vasudeva along with his plenary expansions, Pradyumna, Aniruddha, and Sankarsana. Purport, according to Pancharatra, Narayan is the primeval cause of all expansions of Godhead. These are Vasudeva, Sankarsana, Pradyumna, and Aniruddha. Vasudeva and Sankarsana on the middle left and right. Pradyumna is on the right of Sankarsana, and Aniruddha is on the left of Vasudeva. And thus the four deities are situated. They are known as the four AD camps of Lord Sri Krishna. This is a Vedic Hema mantra beginning with Omkar Pranava, and thus the mantra is established by the transcendental chanting process, namely Om Namo Dhimahi, etc. The purport is that any transaction, either in the field of fruitive work or in empiric philosophy, which is not ultimately aimed at transcendental realization of the Supreme Lord, is considered to be useless. Narada Ji has therefore explained the nature of unalloyed devotional service by his personal experience in the development of intimacy between the Lord and the living entity by a gradual process of progressive devotional activities. Such a progressive march of transcendental devotion to the Lord culminates in the attainment of loving service to the Lord, which is called prema, in different transcendental variegatedness called rasa, taste. Such devotional service is also executed in the mixed forms, namely fruitive work or empiric philosophical speculations. Now, the question which was raised by the great rishis headed by Shonaka regarding the confidential part of Sutta's achievement through the spiritual masters is explained herein by the chanting of this hymn consisting of 33 letters. And this mantra is addressed to the four deities of the Lord with his plenary expansions. The central figure is Lord Sri Krishna because the plenary portions are his aide-de-camps. The most confidential part of the instruction is that one should always chant and remember the glories of the Lord Sri Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, along with his plenary portions, expanded as Vasudeva, Sankarsana, Pradyumna, and Aniruddha. Those expansions are the original deities for all other truths, namely either Vishnu Tattva or Shakti Tattva. Om Gyana Timurandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Saksur and Militam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Mano Vishnam Tapitam Yena Bhutale Sayambhu Pukadamayam Dadati Sapadantikam Panshakalpa Tarubhyascha Kapashindu Baye Vijaya Patitanam bhavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo namo namah. Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Srivasadi Gaur Bhaktavrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. greetings from Amtrak train on the way to Washington, D.C. Because we're on the train, I want to know if people could actually hear me. I don't know if people can unmute their phones. Can people actually hear me? It's okay, Shasta?
Yes, very clear, Maharaj.
Oh, that's amazing because, okay, thank you. So, wow. This is a difficult class for me to give for several reasons. One, I just thought I never like to cancel the class. I feel one of the potencies of the class is its regularity. I think that's so important in spiritual life, that you get habits. And I realize how difficult it is for most people to do anything when they're raising families, having jobs in the modern world, and the kind of energy that goes and the kind of demands that are made on people. And from the very beginning, 8 years ago, when I I don't know if it's 7 or 8 years ago, and I decided to give the class, I kind of knew that it really wouldn't last unless you can make it a habit with people. And therefore, my responsibility was to always give it regularly. Even when I'm in India, I remember giving it, so many, and very rare sometimes, very rarely would I have to cancel it for any amount of time. So, I do like to keep it up. So I didn't know how it really was going to work on the train. And then the other complication is, and this is a complication for traveling, but it was almost mystical. You know, I was packing, yesterday morning early to come into the Bhakti Center, and because there was a wedding of one of the real key congregation members and someone who was a monk there for many years, Doyle Gauranga and Rasika Gopi, and they asked me to attend. So I just arranged it so my train would be out of New York, so I drove down to New York. Was when I was packing in the morning, I just said, should I bring my back brace? You know, those things you wrap around when you have a backache. I just said, I said, why are you bringing this? You know, you're so healthy now, you're so flexible. And anyway, I just threw it in the case. Actually, it was the night before. And then, miraculously, I woke up in the morning with a wrenched back. You know how those things are. I mean, every movement, doesn't have to be pain if you're in one place, but as soon as you move, and sometimes you can't move in different directions. And then somehow I got in my car and I got down to the Bhakti Center, and this morning miraculously made it to the the Amtrak, but it's definitely not conducive. Well, for your morning sadhana, a lot of times with speaking, it's not. I mean, two things are important: is the proper frame of reference, and the proper consciousness, because if the mind is not fixed in the mode of goodness, your mind is not clear. And if your mind is not clear, you can't search the mind for what's in there. And therefore, it says a yogi who, I forgot which of the yams it is, but which of the regulations of the yogi is, but if the yogi has, I forgot which regulation it is, not stealing, or no, it's not that one, or if the yogi is content or something, yeah, if the yogi is content, maybe I think content means when you have the consciousness enough, whether you're poor, whether you're rich, whatever you have. You know, the yogi, to be a yogi, your consciousness has to be enough. I have enough. And we can see when we're not in that consciousness, we never have enough. And we're never satisfied on whatever situation we're in. And therefore, the mind is disturbed, and it's difficult to be a yogi. So, so it says when you see in yoga, in the classical yoga with these regulations and rules, to actually practice yoga, it's not that you're just ahimsa, nonviolent, you don't eat meat. You have to perfect it. So, you know, you have to perfect it. So you have to perfect contentment. You actually have to have a mind that's enough. I'm satisfied. And it says if you perfect any of the yams and niyams, then there's mystical benefits. That's yoga. The benefit you get mysticism. So it says you can know your past birth. And the commentators say because, you know, your past, a lot of your mind is from your past. A lot of your desires and your samskaras and your impressions are from your past. And they're still within your mind because the subtle body carries over. So, what? Why? Because when the mind is so clear, you can see everything. So it's an important principle for me. That's why sometimes the evening classes, when you're tired, are more difficult. It's an important principle for me to have good sadhana in the morning before I go into any particular activity. So waking up in the morning, just to pack my suitcase took 2 hours. It's any little movement, even to get up. And, you know, therefore, it's really on sit, chant. But somehow or other, you know. Anyway, I'm going to just speak a little bit. I don't know how much I'll be able to speak on this verse. Anything that comes out now is Krishna's mercy. So what happened is so in the morning, so I'm giving 2 seminars today in Washington, D.C. Hare Kirtan is arranging them. And I was so determined to come. Even I wasn't really sure how I'd even get to the train station with luggage and things like that. I just moved very slow. Very slow. But sometimes you're in a position where you can't even get up. You don't even know how you'll move, because left or right or front or back. And so I'm giving 2 seminars. One is on cultivating self-confidence through humility. I want to deal on the essence of humility and be able to understand how humility, which entails feelings of a lack of self-worth, I don't know if that's the right word, but sometimes even that it's sometimes extreme modesty in a spiritual sense, lower than the store in the street. You know, what the void of all sense of ready to offer all respects, but more tolerant than a tree, lower than the straw in the street, as a psychological feeling. How doesn't that feed the lack of confidence we have that is at the basis of all our inhibitions and all our fears, you know, and how to resolve that particular contradiction. Because both certain descriptions of humility in high spiritual, especially when one advances spiritually, and parallel so much the symptoms of a lack of self-esteem. Anyway, I want to tackle that on. It's a very interesting seminar. The other one is more informal at Hari Kirtan's house, God Be Blue. So, I always try to relate my seminar, if I'm speaking, to my situation. And that's also a trick of speaking, that somehow or other you have to make yourself very... One second. You have to make yourself relatable to the audience. So one thing I thought I would ask today is describe that. Because I want people to know, in one sense, that I may not be at my best, you know. So one thing I was going to ask them, which I was meditating on myself, is, you know, I wrench my back. I'm moving like lightning on Amos and Andy. I don't know if you ever saw that one. But that was, you know, I'm moving so slow. You know, like a real old man. And now I remember some of the old men. You know, how slow people move. And, you know, I have the genes of my mother. 93, still quite active, energetic. So, you know, I'm my age. I'm quite, you know, the chakras in my body, the energy, the prana in my body is flowing. I'm moving. So I was just saying, this is humbling. So I'm just trying to figure out what is that consciousness of humility? And why would something like this be humbling? Make me humble, or can make me humble? I'm just thinking, because one, I've lost control. Two, I want to look like I am in control. I'm reflecting on myself. You know, I am known for my strength. Now I can't exhibit my attributes. So, you know, in that conscious case of, I guess the opposite, is pride. You know, the sense of control, the sense of superiority, right, the sense of superiority. And here is the sense of non-superiority. Not only non-superiority, but real other lack of power. And I was saying, in a spiritual sense, how that's actually good. Because it's reality. It's actually who we are. And, but it's not just, it's just not, it's who we are, but to someone who has a spiritual sense, it's who we are in love. It's who we are in love. It's who we are in relationship to God. It helps us to see that we are not in the center. It helps us to see that we are servants of the center. It actually helps us to draw on our core existential being, the core heart. It helps us to draw on that and to come into the heart to actually get the feelings of love we need that are obscured by a sense of power.
intended. So anyway, I'm thinking these things now, and part of my class is to really tone down and really get to the core of this feeling of spirituality and help distinguish that feeling from a lack of self-esteem. Because they're so similar. But I see it almost ironically gives you more self-worth. Because our real self-worth is in relationship with God, that we're part of God. And even if we are a small part of God, divine, that connection, that feeling, it's something real, actually. It's real, and it's glorious, and it's wonderful, and if you connect with that, you connect with your smallness. You connect with your smallness. It's actually very, very powerful. So these are kind of some of my thoughts, and I'm going to discuss it in the class. And this kind of class is really good because I state the problem and I ask a lot of questions and I actually try to figure out. Because even myself, it's just like in Bhagavad Gita, to understand spirituality, Krishna puts it in the most extreme condition, fighting and killing with relatives in a war. An extreme putting something in an externally extreme condition really requires that you understand the essence of it. That's why my paradox is so powerful. Because it forces you to not understand something superficially. You have to get beyond the superficiality of something. Anyway, when I speak these things, it's never definitive. It's exploratory. Because it's really, really deep, these type of things. Now, in terms of today's verse in the Bhagavatam,
if we know its context, Narada is explaining to Vyas, is illustrating his teachings to Vyas, that the best presentation of the Vedas is a direct description of Krishna, the most fullest revelation of the personality of Godhead, because that has the maximum degree to make you want to give up ego, to make you really want to be that particle of consciousness. You want to be small when you're satisfied in love. Just like a mother, a child in the arms of the mother. Child in the arms of the mother is happy. Why? Because the child is feeling love. And the child, therefore, feels love. And in true feelings of love, one becomes happy to be out of the center. One feels happy to embrace not a high position, but a relationship of service. And look at the child. No ego in that platform, in one sense.
not wanting to be the controller, not wanting to be the mother, just being sheltered. So somehow or other, this feeling of smallness. Which is the healthy feeling, because we're not God. We're part of something greater. So this healthy feeling, he's telling him, is invoked by the descriptions of Krishna to become attracted to that. And Jnana and Karma have the obstacles of ego. And although they're meant to bring you out of the center, you can very much get stuck in the center by big sacrifices, by so many rules, by so much intellectual and renunciatory power. I don't know if I just made up a word, but... So he's telling him this, and he illustrates by his own life how he became happy in the most humble position. The son of the maidservant, who met the manifestations of God in terms of his gurus. Guru means heavy, guru means great. He met God. The guru gives God. He met that. And he developed faith in service, faith in love. Not faith and power, faith and love. You know, it's an amazing phenomenon. You know, my back was completely wrenched. But you can see you're not the body, because if you begin to speak Krishna Katha, you completely forget the body. If you wanted to be sober at the time of death, chant here and remember Krishna.
No, it was an interesting phenomenon for me, because my consciousness was on every little twist of the body. Of course, now by talking about it, I put myself back in bodily consciousness, but I was marveled for a second. Even Marge Prickett heard the Bhagavatam for 7 days. He didn't... eat or drink. He wasn't focused on that. Consciousness can be focused on anything. And it doesn't have to be focused on pain. It doesn't have to be focused on sound. That's what samadhi is. It's going to be completely focused on the self, and you're not conscious of the body. That's what the purpose of asana is. Asana means to make the body sukha and sthira. It means to make it happy and steady. You make the body happy and steady, then the body is supposed to disappear, because you can't actually perform yoga if your body is not healthy and you're disturbed. So it's kind of an interesting phenomenon. That's what attentive chanting is. That's what yoga is. You have control where to focus your awareness. You can focus your awareness right in the Adya chakra, between the eyebrows. And then you can focus your consciousness completely on hearing. Anyway, such a beautiful story. And Narada is illustrating it. He's got up to the part where they were kind to him because he was so much in need, and it was sincere, and that's bhakti. Bhakti is need plus sincerity. That's bhakti. We all have needs, but the sincere expression of it is bhakti. That's the consciousness of bhakti. And that consciousness comes out as prayers, that consciousness comes out as service, that consciousness comes out in relationship to
humble service, just compassion.
So Narada told how he was, they were taught the Bhagavatam.
Of course, the aim of the Bhagavatam is to glorify Krishna. That's the impetus. But then he explains, interesting, he's finished this section where he explains kind of working in the world. And almost a contradiction, because work generally is karma. This work is generally done from the platform of ego. And therefore, we're attracted to so many
types of works and activities from the platform of ego. But in the bhakti path, you take that same work that's constitutionally born from ego and transfer it into service by dedicating it to God.
And now, in this particular verse, almost concluding that section, he's talking about when you aim your work, your gyan, your karma, when you aim what you have, when you give what you have, when you surrender what you have,
when you surrender it to realize God, it becomes very valuable. And when you don't, no matter what you do, it becomes useless, even if you perform religion. It's not aimed at awakening the soul, the love in the soul, which is expressed by chanting. It becomes useless. Dharma sanushti tapum sadhikseinakatasya dopariyegitiritimsha. Any work which is not aimed at God becomes useless.
It becomes useless. Therefore, he says, let us therefore chant about Krishna and Krishna's incarnations.
And this is one of the questions. Tell us about the incarnations of Krishna. So he said, yes, let us chant.
Let us chant the glories. Namaha, Bhagavate, Rupam, unto you, the personality of God, let us
offer obeisances. Dimahi, let us meditate, let us chant.
Therefore, he's telling them, yes.
Let us chant the glories. And therefore, you should present the Vedas in a way, you should edit the Vedas in a way that this is what is done. That this is what is done. Let us chant the glories and let's do it in a way that this is what is done. Therefore, let us chant. And we'll do the next verse in some discussion. Iti murta pidanena bantra murta namurtikam yajiteya gipurisham sattam yadvarshanapumam. Thus he is the actual seer who worships in the form mantra murta, in the form of the sound vibration, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who has no material form. Let's read another one of Prabhupada's purports. Our present senses are made of material elements, and therefore they are imperfect in realizing the transcendental form of Lord Vishnu. He is therefore worshipped by sound representation via the transcendental method of chanting. Yeah, it's not. What it means is it's not an intellectual process to realize God. So you can't impose material conceptions on God. So faith is often, I often describe faith, and I got it from different people I read, as a sense. Not just an intellectual conception. But the reason allows us to move forward and how it opens our consciousness to that experience. And therefore, the form of transcendental sound,
it is equal to the form of God. We actually understand that
Krishna is blue, but it's not material blue. But through meditating on Krishna with our present conceptions, which are limited, we get a realization of what Krishna is beyond how we impose our own experience based on our mind, which is based on our own experience of so many desires in this world, just like Radha and Krishna. It's the form of a mundane relationship. But it's not a material form of a mundane relationship. It has nothing to do with a mundane relationship. But somehow or other, even though we may see those forms and project our own experience on them, which they are not, a murti come, they're not that form. But somehow or other, because the descriptions are coming from the Shastra, then somehow or other, a glimpse of the reality of it enters our consciousness the more we meditate on it and the more we try to understand it. It's the same thing with the holy name. It's the form. It is God, but we don't experience it as God because we project our own attachments on it. Anything which is beyond the scope of experience by our perfect senses can be realized by the sound vibration. Beyond the purview of our senses, but it's realized, it's experienced by the sound vibration. Even the studying of the Bhagavad. When I put the first and second canto on tape, when I had this assistant, James Bay, and I put it on tape, you know, he would listen and I would speak. But it wasn't just intellectual, it was experiential. But the method of that experience was our intellect. But intellect in a particular attitude of submissive hearing. It goes way beyond the intellect. It's an experience of God. And the example is given, I believe I read in the commentary where they discuss the Yoga Sutras, chanting the names of God as the best object of meditation. When a commentator, they describe that as God is controlling the world and he sets the laws, he can transform matter into spirit according to his laws, just as he can transform one material element into another. Like he can transform metal into fire. If you put metal into fire, the metal becomes fire-eyed. And not any element will become fire-eyed. Some elements will become consumed. Some elements are water's resistant to have any effect. But metal becomes fire-eyed. So similarly, there's certain combinations of sound vibrations that become Ishwar-eyed, become Krishna-eyed. So we listen to them. We impose our material conception of sound on them. But as we listen to them in the right way, we experience something beyond sound. We experience God. We experience something beyond the elements in which that was formed. We experience transcendence. We experience God. We experience our soul. A person transmitting sound from a far distant place can be factually experienced. If this is materially possible, why not spiritually? This experience is not a vague and personal experience. It's actually an experience of the transcendental personality of God, who possesses the pure form of eternity bliss knowledge. The Amarko Sanskrit dictionary, the word murti carries import in twofold meanings, namely form and difficulty. Therefore, murtikam is explained by the Acharya Vishwanath as meaning without difficulty. So it's mantra murtim amurtikam. We're experiencing the form of the mantra without difficulty.
transcendental form of eternal bliss and knowledge can be experienced by original spiritual senses, which can be revived by chanting of the holy mantras or transcendental sound vibrations. Such sound should be received from the transparent agency of a bona fide spiritual master, and the chanting may be practiced by the direction of the spiritual master. That will gradually lead us nearer to the Lord. This method of worship is recommended in the Pancharatriki system, which is both recognized and authorized. The Pancharatriki system has the most authorized codes for transcendental devotional service. Without the help of such codes, one could not approach the Lord, certainly not by dry philosophical speculation. The Pancharatriki system is both practical and suitable for this age, and far the Pancharatriki is more important than the Vedanta for this modern age. So Pancharatriki system, based on the Vedas, is a system of worship that practically enables you to approach Lord. Well, the Vedanta is a philosophical analysis that becomes a little bit more difficult. Anyway, if anybody would like to ask a question or say hello.
Hare
Krishna, do you have a question?
Yeah, I do. And I just want to say something before I ask my question. I really appreciate the way you are determined to give those classes. It's a lot of inspiration for me to see you in different conditions, different places, just speaking Krishna Katha. So I really appreciate that. And my
question,
when you spoke about in the beginning about the seminar you're giving and how it's important to feel small, which can help us in our humility, I was wondering if you can expand and explain a little bit how we can do it with compassion or self-compassion, because I know for myself sometimes I become too heavy with myself when I'm not able to do or perform the way I like, and then it's more discouraging than feeling humble. So maybe you can expand on that bit.
Yeah, wow. I guess it's the same point that it's a very, very deep point, but I think what it lies in is where our self-deprecation is coming from. Where our heaviness is coming from. On the purest spiritual platform, it's coming from love. You know, we're thinking of God, and we're thinking of our service and our desire to serve God. And it's born of that feeling. It's just like the difference between love and codependence. Love, you're serving others, thinking of others. Codependence is you're thinking of others for yourself. So it really depends where that is coming from, because obviously we also want to have a certain amount of remorse, you know, remorse on for our past. We don't want to just rationalize. We want to burn away the false ego by reflecting on how we are lacking in relationship to God. So that's a very healthy feeling. But I think when it becomes debilitating, it's because there's an element in it of ego. We are disappointed because we're not because we're better servants of God. We're disappointed because we're worse controllers of the world. So it's and a lot of times it's mixed. It's not one another. You know, very sincere people. They don't rationalize. They're tough on themselves. They look you know, they look at themselves critically. You know, so it's not that. So it's a very subtle point between the two, but I really think it's what the objective is. I always call humility as happy small. See, a lot of lack of self-esteem is we lack self-worth because our self-objective is to be the controller and enjoyer. It's constantly being reinforced in society. And humility is the same kind of desire, but more regretting that desire to be the controller and the enjoyer. And not serving God the proper way. Anything else?
No, thank you, Maharaj. I will listen to it a few times. It's a deep answer. Thank you.
Yeah, I think I have to think of that a little bit more too. Okay. Well, thank you for asking it. And as you were appreciating that I'm regular, I really appreciate the people who on the Sunday that are regular too. Anybody else like to ask a question?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, this is Atmananda.
Atmananda, you know, I meant to call you. It was on my list and just somehow or other, but I'll try to do it this week. I'd like to catch up with you, really. But anyway, Atmananda, yes, any questions?
Thank you for the talk.
Okay, wonderful. Okay.
I want to ask you also, the jiva is bound by the material energy, and then we're trying to, our attempt here in bhakti is to try to come under the control of the internal energy of Krishna. So, but that is it really like, what part do we play in it? Do we just ask, we're just asking to come under that control of that energy, but how to what extent is our determination play a part in that? Because determination seems like a kind of a ascending kind of way. That determination, you know, to practice the sadhana very strictly and all those things. That seems like kind of contradictory in a way to the humility and just being surrendered to come under that control of the internal potency.
Well, I mean, what is our determination for? Our determination can be based on a well of humility that I've been separated from God, you know, and it can be, it's not that by practice alone we achieve God. But practice has to be it can be very much an expression of that humility and dependence. And the determination may be the determination to call out to God. But like Narada Muni showed, we'll see this later, when the determination is mixed with a sense of my own power and an expectation that by my power and my determination, I will achieve God. It doesn't work because there's nothing we can do to earn God. If we can never pay for God with our own, we can never pay for God with our own effort. God is not cheap. But if the effort is the calling, if the effort is more than a reflection of the ego, the effort is a reflection of our utter dependence that makes us express this utter dependence. So, yes, if the determination is just this ego, I am powerful, I can do, right, it's antithetical to achieve. Or maybe it is helpful too. But not on the
ultimate sense. Not on the ultimate sense that it can't get you to God. It can help you to begin your vaidhi, your practices. You can use your determination. You could use your ego. If that kind of, you know, I was a sportsman and, you know, you see that in sportsmen, you know, their utter faith in their own power, kind of determination to achieve things, then you're not going to get very far. Despite you being the best chapa chanter or chanting the most rounds, or we've seen so many of those people, you know. So, yes, that type of determination that's born of ego, born of the sense of conquering with my power, and with expectation of results and achievement by my power, no, you won't get very far. But if the determination, if the determination is, I've been so separated from God, I'm dedicating the rest of my life to God, and I'm going to sit here and cry and cry and cry until he hears my voice. Does that help, Abhinanda?
Yeah, it does. Thank you.
Okay, let's try to talk and catch up. I know you sent me your number. Send it to me again, just in case, okay?
Okay.
I'd really like to talk to you. Okay, anybody else like to ask a question? Anybody like to say hello?
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Who's this?
This is Gordon.
Gordon, always great to hear from you. We will, maybe we'll see you at the immersion later on, possibly.
Yes.
You'll be getting something. That's great. Okay. Thanks, Gordon.
Thank you, Maharaj.
Okay. Anybody else like to say hello? Okay. Thank you all for coming on and allowing me to transcend my body by absorption of Krishna Katha. Thank you.